Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Years ago, today's guest put a dog puppet on his hand and started making poop jokes in a thick Russian accent. It's never stopped being funny. This is The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast, and today I'm talking to the legendary comedian behind Triumph the Insult Comic Dog, Robert Smigel. Robert first brought Triumph to life on Late Night with Conan O'Brien in the late 90s. Since then, he's confronted everyone from the Westminster Dog Show and Star Wars nerds to Ted Cruz and Lindsey Graham. And he always brings the perfect blend of stupid humor and biting satire. This month, he produced a new Triumph benefit special for Funny or Die called Quarantine Squares, in which he simultaneously quizzes and mocks celebrities like Jason Alexander, Susie Essman, and Anthony Scaramucci. It's hilarious. I could not have been more excited to talk to Robert, not only about Triumph, but also about his many years at SNL, where he wrote and starred in sketches like Da Bears and created the ambiguously gay duo, a concept he readily admits would not work in 2020. Okay, this is me and Robert Smigel. I want to talk about the Quarantine Squares game show that you just put out.
Thank you.
Because it was really great. So fun.
Oh, did you like it?
Yeah. It was really, really funny and just so surreal to see all of those people in little squares. It was a pretty perfect use of the technology that we're all using now.
Absolutely. I've been wanting to do a Triumph-hosted quiz show for many years. It's one of many Triumph ideas I just haven't been able to sell. And I had this idea of doing these Jeopardy-type questions where the punchline is in the form of a question, and it just felt like a really fresh way to do Triumph's sort of smart-ass humor. I just could not get it done, but I had this idea in the back of my head, and I thought it would make a great podcast. But I wanted to do it with an audience. I wanted to, you know, go to the Bell House in Brooklyn or a place like that. You know, I tried to sell it to big companies, which turned out to be just another waste of energy. So then I just mounted it myself for the New York Comedy Festival at a place called the Murmur Ballroom. And then the pandemic happened and I just tabled it. And
Live shows not really working so much right now. I really wanted to go to that live show in New York. I wanted to go and I didn't make it, but I did listen to it when you put it out as a podcast and it was great. And I really enjoyed Anthony Scaramucci you got on there, which was
very
score.
Game. I guess I shouldn't have been surprised. The guy who had nothing to lose was willing to say anything, make guesses. The other two people were a little buttoned down in that.
Yeah, Pete Davidson doesn't like to talk a lot about himself, probably.
Well, he's doing his own stand-up, understandably, you know, he's in control.
Very confessional, yeah.
He's an incredibly nice guy, but it wasn't best use for him and Lawrence O'Donnell. Lawrence O'Donnell was a miracle that I got anyone from MSNBC to get within 10 feet of Triumph. Yeah. So he was there, but he was not willing to knock it out of the park as far as going for these punchlines. You're supposed to guess punchlines, basically. Yeah. You're playing the game. And he was afraid to, like, some of the categories had filthy names to them.
Yeah, he didn't want to even say it out loud. But Scaramucci will do pretty much anything. And you have him on the Quarantine Squares as well.
Yes, this was proof positive. Scaramucci would indeed do anything, say anything. And of course, he's the most willing to come back and do it again. And the guy who DMs me the most on Twitter about.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What does he talk to you about? You
know, hey, anytime, man. When are we going to do another one? And way to go. You're a genius.
It's hilarious.
Same stuff he would say to Donald Trump, I'm sure. You're the man.
Yeah.
You're the man. What? I'm out? Okay. All right. Yeah. Fuck you.
But then on this one, he bailed early. What happened?
He had to bail early. I was like, any mooch is better than no mooch. So I just went for it.
Fun just to see him there anyway.
Well, the fun was, like, the second he left, everybody started trashing him behind his back.
Yeah.
Which was very enjoyable. Susie Essman, Jason Alexander. Yeah, Everybody's laughing.
Tom Arnold you had there. That was good.
It was the opposite of the first podcast where everybody was like kind of tense because there was an audience. And here, everybody, there was no audience. And I thought, oh, am I going to have to like play this back for a Zoom audience later? Oh, no. I realized immediately that would be intrusive because this just felt like a party, you know, as it was. And welcome to our special Quarantine Squares edition of Let's Make a Poop. How are you, celebrities?
Loving life.
Great.
Lots of Corona calories.
I love your backgrounds. Love them. Very few pretentious bookshelves. Only Scaramucci, who we know is an avid reader. Everybody was like a great sport. So for me, it was like a pleasure to be doing it in such a relaxed environment.
As opposed to what you're usually dealing with.
It's the most stressful thing I do in my career.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, the most successful, the most beloved thing I do.
Yeah.
But it's not really my nature. It's my nature to push boundaries and bite the hand that feeds me, quote unquote. But for me, physically, to be confrontational, that is not me at all. Even when I do triumph, I almost always try to ask the person in advance, is it okay if you talk to my puppet here?
But you couldn't always do that with some, especially with some of the political people. It's not so easy to do. You just kind of have to go for
it. You have no choice when you're in the middle of like, oh my God, it's so stressful to go to these debates.
Yeah.
And then you're in the spin room afterward and everybody's taking it.
I've been there too. It's crazy.
Yeah, and everybody's taking it really seriously. And also when I did these Hulu specials in 2016, and I would go to a town hall and John Kasich would be speaking, and it would be so easy for me to yell something and get a big laugh, but I just couldn't bring myself to do it.
Really?
I just felt like I'm not going to be that guy who makes it that much about him and his character. I want to be respectful of the process to that degree. I don't want to. A lot of people work hard at this, and contrary to what goes out, there are a lot of people who are sincerely believe they're doing it for the right reasons. There are plenty of opportunists, plenty of scumbags out there too, but there are people who support candidates and work on campaigns for other reasons, for purer reasons. And I just don't feel right about being that level of disruptive.
Do you have a kind of favorite confrontation with a political person that you've done over the last several years? I mean, for me, it's Ted Cruz, I think.
Yeah. Ted Cruz was a gift. I never thought in a million years that Ted Cruz would come up to me and be willing to speak. Like, we went to Texas with no expectation of talking to either candidate. I thought I was just going to make fun of the supporters and make Ted Cruz jokes to the supporters, and that would be the end of it. But we go to a Ted Cruz rally, and Ted Cruz is meeting and greeting people on the stage afterward. And one of my writers was with me, a guy named David Feldman, a very funny guy, has his own podcast on Pacifica. And he just had the balls to get on stage, and he's in his 50s, and he's yelling over, Ted, Harvard Law School, remember me? He's just faking it. He's just pretending he went to Harvard Law School. And then Ted doesn't really quite get his attention. And he's like, Triumph, the insult comic dog. And at one point, Ted notices him. You know, he wasn't listening to the Harvard Law School, but when he heard Triumph, he actually kind of lit up. And I knew that he would be aware of Triumph because in 2016, I did an entire remote for Hulu where I chased Ted Cruz. Remember, he had that bus, the Cruiser, the Cruise Express, the whatever they called it. And I would just go from town to town, chasing him and getting in his sight line. And again, I would not yell, I would not disrupt the event, but I would be there and I would make little side comments to people who were next to me. And I would yell at him when he was walking through and leaving, Ted, one more question, you know. But it was enough for them to be very upset. So my talent booker, Julie, calls me and says, the Cruz people have called. They want to know what it's going to take for you to stop showing up at every event. Want to talk to Ted or what, you know,
let's negotiate.
So they're willing to talk to me or something. She said, perhaps. And I said, you know what? I like the way this is working. So Ted Cruz, he thinks he's funny. And apparently he thought that he could hold his own and all would be fine, you know? So he had a very, very big, grandiose kind of gesture of like welcoming Triumph. Please, please, you know, bringing his arm to his chest. Come along, come along. And then the rest is like, we put almost all of it on Colbert, you know, the exchange.
Yeah, it was such a great, the whole thing was so great.
He's gotta, yeah, and it was very, very stressful for me because a couple of things, because I had no, again, I had no expectation that I was going to get to talk to Ted Cruz. I didn't even have like, we write a lot of jokes in advance, but I never wrote, like, I never put together a section of like, what would I say to Ted Cruz? And also not only that, but I don't want to say anything that's going to be too gross or dark or anything that he could use as ammo to like talk about, because this was like right after the Kavanaugh hearings. After the Kavanaugh hearings, and you know, there was that moment where the activists confronted, I think it was Jeff Flake in an elevator. There were there were a lot of protests, and they had come up with this new phrase. The mob is what they labeled.
The mob is coming for them.
The people who are against rape, basically. The mob. So people who want to see at least a fair exploration of whether this guy did what.
Yeah, before he gets a lifetime appointment.
Yeah, before he gets a lifetime appointment, which was not to be, obviously, the investigation that they had hoped for. But the mob was what they were, you know, labeled. So I didn't want to do anything to feed that narrative. So I was eliminating some of the crasser jokes. For that reason, like, for example, there was a joke about when Trump hugged you at the rally when you were together, was he technically grabbing another pussy? You know, that kind of thing. I didn't want to say that. So I had a few that were mild enough, but still funny enough. Mm-hmm. I only did a couple. And then he kind of gave me a softball. And he thought he had this big checkmate smile on his face. And everybody around him who was frowning, that was the second thing that was terrifying about the moment was that, you know, usually when I do a Triumph remote, even if I go to a Republican convention, there are plenty of people who are Triumph fans who are willing to laugh. Lots of Republican delegates have senses of humor about it and are willing to laugh. It'll be interesting to see if that maintains this year, because there's a different level of like digging in with Trump supporters at this stage, I would say. And a defensiveness that may make things more contentious. But generally, and Ted Cruz is not unlike those guys, Republican guys who have a sense of humor about it, and women. And but everybody around Ted Cruz, it's their job to win his trust by protecting him. So the last thing any of them are going to do is give me even a smile. They're just giving me just a circle of stink eye. You know, so I'm not getting any laughs. I'm just hoping that Colbert's audience is going to find this funny. I'm getting nothing. And then finally, he thinks he's got me. And then he makes this joke. Like, remember, it was the Democrats who took you to the veterinarian to get neutered. I don't even know exactly what it meant, but it got a huge laugh among everybody around him.
His people loved it.
And he's just like, got a big smile and shoulders are starting to vibrate and he's nodding and like, you know, checkmate. But it turned out it was actually a softball. And I just said, yes, no, I'm with you. I am totally against, I totally support spaying and neutering, especially the way Trump neutered you. Some people did laugh because they had to, and he laughed. He actually went, "Dah!" Like, you got me.
Yeah.
Which I gave him credit for.
Yeah.
You know, let's be civil here, okay? Because this man, nobody should be yelling at this man in a public place. I mean, doesn't the man have the right to sit down in a restaurant and enjoy a meal that five waiters have spit in?
Well, I will say to Triumph two things. One, as a Cuban American, anyone smoking a cigar can't be all bad.
That's right.
And two, I just want to say to Triumph, my advice is walk away.
Walk away.
And just remember, it wasn't the Republicans, it was the Democrats that took you into the vet to get fixed. And there is freedom on the other side.
I support spaying and neutering, just like Trump did to you. I
kid! All right.
No, I gave him credit for that, and he and then I haven't ever said this, and I'm going to regret it. But he actually, so then as a joke, Triumph, I high-fived him with my paw. because I thought it would look funny. And then I was like, no, I'm not going to use that in the remote because
too generous.
Too generous. It'll look like, you know, that'll be the freeze frame that other that they pull. You know,
you weren't going to give them that.
It's just all about, like, we live in this internet world where everything, you know, one moment can be pulled out of context and redefine anything. And I was like, you know, on the one hand, I like that he was a good sport about it, but I think that's going to come off anyway. I think it came across anyway.
You didn't need the high five.
I need a bunch of jerks using this against somehow.
But you went at Beto too, and when you ended up meeting with him, you know, you didn't give him a pass either.
No, I mean, I think I, you know, in fairness, was rougher on Ted Cruz, but Ted Cruz is like a lightning rod.
Makes
He's
sense.
One of the most hated people in the Senate. I think a lot of Republicans hate him too. Mm-hmm. But they deal with him, but he's much more controversial. I mean, even for a Republican, than Beto's like a newcomer. I had a couple of harsh jokes about Democrats voting twice, that kind of thing. As a Democrat, is it more important than ever this year to vote twice? It's like that kind of thing.
Do you have any plans to do anything this year? Because we don't even really know what
I think it's
real
possible,
life campaigning will be yet.
That's the thing. I mean, I wouldn't go out tomorrow, that's for sure. You know, I'm getting up there and there's no way my wife would let me.
Yeah.
It's like, it's not even a discussion. She's not going to let me go. She would never let me go to a Trump rally right now.
Yeah. What about the convention?
Years. The convention's a couple of months away, and I think it's possible.
Coming up, Robert looks back at his long tenure at SNL and reveals that his eventual exit was, quote, not pretty.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This episode of The Last Laugh is brought to you by Vanderpump Villa, a new reality show starring Lisa Vanderpump, now streaming only on Hulu. Join Lisa and her hand-selected staff at Chateau Rosabelle, a glamorous estate in the French countryside. Meet the elite staff as they work, live, and play together 24/7, while dealing with rivalry, romance, and misadventures. As they try to provide once-in-a-lifetime experiences for their guests, the staff will need to meet Lisa's high standards. Not everybody has what it takes. Watch new episodes of Vanderpump Villa every Monday, now on Hulu. It's pretty crazy. I was looking back at, you know, Triumph's origin and the fact that it's been 23 years. I mean, can you believe that you've been doing this for that long?
23 years, huh? Wow. No, I can't. I can't. I mean, the whole thing was an accident. I've told that story many times.
Yeah.
I don't know if you want to.
I mean, I think, you've told about how you found the puppet and all that.
Yes.
And that
started on
Late Night with Conan O'Brien.
Yes.
But what I was curious about is you mentioned that, like, you're not very confrontational by nature. I think Triumph was not necessarily very confrontational at the beginning, right? I mean,
the idea was
not that you were going out and insulting people.
No.
You know, in the wild, so to speak.
When I thought of it, I was taking a shower one morning and I knew that Westminster was coming up, and we had established this Westminster bit that I had started when my wife bought me these puppets originally, where they all have different talents, like singing the bodyguard theme or playing dueling banjos or a magician sawing another dog puppet in half or lighting their own farts or a doggy Jack Nicholson impressionist who, like, pulls his paw. He did the hacky thing where he pulls his hair back with his paw. I am Jack Nicholson. They all have the Russian accent. I insisted on that. And then this is literally like, I've left the show. I only come back to do Bob Dole and all the other Clutch Cargo bits, the talking mouth bits. And I just call John Groff and say, oh, Westminster's, you want to do another one of those dog show things? Because I thought of Insult Comic, and I think that would be really funny. And he liked the idea. And really, the only joke I had was the joke was going to be on the puppet, that his repertoire was so limited because he was a dog, and all he could do was compliment somebody and then say, for me to poop on, just the switcheroo.
Yeah.
That was basically the idea.
And that was the whole bit.
That was basically the whole bit. The joke was on the dog, and the audience loved it. And, you know, I mean, I think I had one joke about, you know, Siskel and Ebert, I would still hump Siskel's leg. I don't even remember. Some leg humping joke. And it did so well that we brought it back. And then I quickly realized that it actually worked perfectly in that spot in the show, which is, it's not at the top of the show, but it was after Conan interviews his first guest. That's when I made fun of Siskel and Ebert in that first one. And I realized that Conan, who's always been a very polite person by nature, his comedy always comes out of a lot of goofiness and, you know, we would do satirical stuff, but it was always in the most silly, indirect way when we started that show. And Conan's politeness made him very likable. But at the same time, when he would have somebody on like John Tesh or David Hasselhoff or William Shatner for two acts, it would actually provide some catharsis for the audience to have this cute little dog puppet take a big shit on that person in a way that Conan would never do. Yeah. And Conan could always feign. And Conan was always really funny as, like, I don't know how he got in here. Like, that kind of attitude.
There is something about the puppet and Triumph that you know, get away with things that other people couldn't, right? Or that
absolutely. I mean, there's a level, 100%. I mean, for one thing, it's just inherently meaner for a human being to make fun of Star Wars fans than for an adorable fictional puppet. Plus, there's an extra layer of irony because Triumph's got a bow tie and a cigar, and his rhythm is very Catskills, old school. Even though we try to write really funny jokes, the fact that Triumph adheres to this dinosaur kind of conceit sort of lowers his status even more, you know? So it becomes kind of like the jester and the kind of thing where, you know, you can make jokes in front of the king and the king's not going to be offended. And a lot of times it works that way. And other times we still piss people off.
Yeah.
But like a good example, so the Star Wars fans, a friend of mine suggested I do that. He had an office outside the Ziegfeld Theater and he told me about the line. I proposed it and they told me, oh, we pitched that. We actually thought of doing that for Conan. And then they said, we'll talk to Conan about it. And Conan inherently understood exactly what I just articulated, that it would come off way funnier and less mean to have the puppet doing it than for Conan to be out there making fun of the nerds.
Yeah.
And yeah, so he had the right instinct. So he gave up that one and said, yeah, no, send Triumph. And of course, that's the one I hear about more than any to this day and always will, probably. And that's fine.
Yeah.
I don't need to top it.
It's premiere night here for Attack of the Clones, but outside the Ziegfeld Theater is the real show, Return of the Dorks. Thousands of 35-year-old men waiting days, even months, for just a taste of George Lucas's table scraps. Lonely men who have never had sex, not even with a Catholic priest.
Are there people that you think about when you look back that have handled it particularly bad, reacted particularly poorly?
There were events that were much harder than others. I mean, the last impeachment trial was very hard.
Yeah.
When I did for Colbert in January, nobody wanted to talk to me. Everybody was very, very tense. And I can't believe I would say things to Lindsey Graham as he would walk by, but he would just ignore them.
Yeah.
And then finally, we did a thing at the end where I held up a sign right behind Lindsey Graham saying, Triumph holds up the sign saying, we'll lie for rubles. And fairly aggressive politically for Triumph to do, but it just seemed so funny if we could get away with it.
They ignore the reporters too, so you don't have to feel too bad that they were ignoring you.
Well, no, this was when he was in a scrum that he stopped for and was answering questions, and they were all there and they all saw it.
Yeah, you were in the scrum, but you didn't get any questions in.
No, could never get a question in. We did get to have that sign, and it's a great meme if you go to my...
Yeah.
If you go to Triumph's Twitter site,
yeah,
it's there. So there's that one. And then the Michael Jackson trial was a very, very difficult experience because people from all over the world had descended upon Santa Maria, California. People had come from all over the world who refused to believe
mostly his fans. I mean, right? They're the ones who were out there.
Oh, yeah. No, these are all his dedicated fans. And they're all, again, they're all dressed in crazy outfits, which made it even funnier. And they were so mad, and they were very shrewd and organized. They would shame people for talking to me. A guy from Scotland would be like, you know, can't you see? He's going to take the piss out of you. You know, there was one French lady who was dressed as like a harlequin, like just a really puffy harlequin outfit. And she's like, no, 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 I do not talk. I will not talk to you. And I was like, yeah, I understand. wouldn't want to compromise your dignity. And then, but they would curse. They got very clever and organized. And like when I would get somebody to agree to talk to me, they would start chanting, fuck, 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 to ruin the audio.
Wow.
To ruin the audio. So we had to come back a second day and wear them down. And we brought like lemonade and suntan lotion. And they were getting tired of us and used to us. And we got just enough jokes to get it done.
To do something with it, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's a great remote. It's really funny, but it took a lot more time. Yeah. And thankfully, the Conan people are very supportive and understanding when that kind of thing happens. Yeah. It's happened a few times where it's like, we need another day. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Speaking of Michael Jackson, what's the story behind the Michael Jackson TV Funhouse? Wasn't that a whole thing?
One of them was, it's all about the timing. When I did SNL cartoons, I did them. I had three ideas. I had the Ambiguously Gay Duo, which I had done at the Dana Carvey Show.
Right.
And I had Fun with Real Audio over the summer.
Those are always my favorite.
Yeah. And that got me really excited. And then I had the Ex-Presidents. Mm-hmm. That came out over the summer. And then my last idea, okay, four. And then my fourth thing was, I'd like to do cartoons about public figures and make them like a Hanna-Barbera character. So we did this thing with Michael Jackson where the joke was that he was like Yogi Bear, basically. And it was just a very playful theme song. And he's basically swiping little boys like they're picnic baskets. And the first time we did it, we didn't hear a peep from anybody because this was, I think, 1996. And I believe he had had a trial recently that was settled out of court. He had had a lawsuit. So there was motivation to do it. And then later in 2005, when the Michael Jackson trial hit and I was doing the Triumph thing, I also did a cartoon about it on Saturday Night Live. And again, no problem because it was in the news. But there was one other cartoon I did in the year 2000 or something where I was just like, I don't know, I got nothing. Let me do another Michael Jackson. I had some funny sight gag ideas, like where he would, where he builds a catapult and he sits on a catapult and it's going to spring him over the roof or over this big wall and into some sort of children's school or something. And so we do it. And gets a lot of laughs, but they threatened to sue. We heard from Michael Jackson's lawyers, NBC did. This is libelous because, you know, there's nothing in the news that's indicating any of this.
No reason to suggest that Michael Jackson might have done something untoward.
Right. Yes. Because all there was the rumors and settling out of court years ago. So they threatened to sue and NBC yanked it from the reruns and it's never been seen. Since then.
Wow. You could have brought it back after leaving Neverland.
Yeah.
That would have been a good reason to bring it back. Do you feel like
beating a dead horse? Yeah.
I feel like the TV Funhouse stuff, it's sort of similar to the way you get away with Boris Triumph than you would as yourself. It's like you were able to get away with so much more in the cartoons than they do in the sketches, don't you think? I mean, they were really hard-hitting satire.
Some of the physical stuff as well. Obviously, you know, things in Ace and Gary.
Yeah.
That, you know, you wouldn't be able to get away with two humans. Not then, anyway.
Yeah. And I do wonder about Ambiguously Gay Duo, whether that would fly now.
Well, I wouldn't write it now because it's not about, thankfully, people have let go. To be clear, the operative engine of that joke was our obsession with sexuality.
Yeah.
To me, the stars of that bit, when I wrote it, were always the villains. You know, Ace and Gary, I did a lot of physical jokes that were kind of a play on the, you know, that whole era from the 80s and going into the Batman superhero movies where just the inherent contradiction of Stallone and Schwarzenegger, like hyper-masculine action movies, but the bodies are sweating and there's all this homoerotic imagery underneath the surface. that I always found amusing. And but the real joke was just the premise that I came up with was all about the villains are obsessed with finding out whether these guys are gay or not, and they can't get their evil work done because they're too obsessed.
They're so distracted.
Staring at these guys. Yeah. And the reason I thought it was so funny was because it's not just homophobes who were obsessed. This was just sport and titillation that was accepted and considered non-controversial in any way. I always found that it was kind of hilarious to me that these people who were supposedly progressive gave a shit at all.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and yeah, that was really the bottom line point of the cartoon was,
yeah,
who gives a shit, you know, of whether, how they fuck. It doesn't, yeah, matter. It's sad that this has to be something that people get defined by. They have to at this point because they're still fighting for basic human rights, you know, still to this day. Thankfully, there's been, you know, an incredible amount of progress, but it's not done. This is all kind of stuff that needs to be in the rearview mirror, but it's not there yet. But it's a lot better than it was 20 years ago, thankfully. Mm-hmm. And for that reason, there'd be really no reason to write the ambiguously gay duo.
Yeah. You were working on a movie for a while, right? Or you were developing a movie?
I did. I wrote a movie with Colbert in the year 2005. It was for Jim Carrey.
Oh, wow.
And yeah,
he was going to play the villain, or he was going to
play Ace. Colbert and I, because Colbert, of all the people who would help me write, different people helped me write different cartoons. Colbert was my main guy who helped me with Ace and Gary.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he had a great ear, especially for those kind of double entendre lines, mm-hmm, that Ace and Gary would say. Just a great ear for it.
Yeah, and I feel like a lot of people still don't know that it was him and Steve Carell doing the voices all that time.
That's right.
On SNL.
That's right, because it was the first thing they did for the Dana Carvey show when, like, Colbert had just gotten off a plane and went straight to a recording studio. Yeah. And I made him Ace and Colbert the sidekick Gary. Yeah, so Jim Carrey met with us. We wrote a script, and then we waited literally a year for an answer, and we got back that his managers were split. One of them was like, this is great, and the other one was like, you're never going to be Tom Hanks if you do this. You're 40 years old. And so he didn't do it, and then a couple of years later he did Dumb and Dumberer.
Yeah. You were at SNL for such a long time. Why did you end up leaving? What was the sort of catalyst to move on?
I was
on from
asked
SNL?
To leave, finally.
Yeah.
I mean, listen, I got to write there for 8 years. Then I took a few years off doing other things, writing movies, and then the Dana Carvey show. And then I went back when I had the cartoon idea. I got to do the cartoons for 11 years there. So now we're into like 2008 by now.
Mm-hmm.
And I had started there in 1985.
It's wild.
And, you know, so as 8 years and then two off and then 11 years with cartoons. And it was not pretty the way it ended. I
really?
Got to be honest. Yeah, because, and I talked about it in the SNL book, and it wasn't Lorne at all. He was very gracious. They took advantage of, first of all, it was an era where the show was not, I thought it had an amazing cast at the time, actually, one of their, maybe their best cast ever, but I don't think the network, it really wasn't until Sarah Palin that the mm-hmm. show took off to the next level.
Yeah, and really hasn't been the same since, I think.
Well, it's been, but it's been more relevant ever since than it was before then.
Not necessarily a bad way, I just mean that changed it, I think, in terms of the celebrity
Absolutely.
Cameos and the...
Yes, yes, yeah. yes. That's subjective, but in terms of its relevance... Its mm-hmm. seeming relevance, it took it to another level. The first thing that did was the Lonely Island videos, you know, kind of.
Yeah.
And that sort of pushed the show in a whole much better direction, I think. But this is like right before that. This is like 2007. In 2007, they fired like four great cast members. They fired Rachel Dratch and Horatio mm-hmm. and Parnell, and I believe somebody else. And it felt like I barely got by. Like, my cartoons had gotten pretty expensive, partly because I was giving the animators raises and also because I was doing them faster than ever because I wanted them to be more topical.
Yeah.
Partly, like, I always approached the show like, what does the show need? You know, even though I had a lot of freedom with the cartoons, like, once Will Ferrell left and they didn't have a Bush they were totally confident in, I started doing more political pointed cartoons about the administration because I felt the show needed to. I felt like, yeah, we were being a little tame. And so...
Yeah, and they never quite figured out Obama, I don't think, so...
Yeah, they got a lot of crap for having Armisen do it, and then Jay Farrow got to do it, but they didn't like, I don't know, they never got a handle on writing for Obama.
Really. Yeah.
So then this is now, you know, those three guys get dumped because the show is not a gigantic, again, it's pre-Sarah Palin.
Yeah.
And so they're looking to cut budget. And then the next year, the writer's strike hits and everything is stopped for a while. And then I'm told that they're not going to renew you. Every SNL contract has a formal thing in it where, at least it used to be all the years I was there, where they had an option to renew you like in December or New Year's, right around then, mm-hmm. for the second half of the season. And it was always a formality. But this one year, because of the writer's strike, I know that Jeff Zucker in particular and the NBC in general were looking to get rid of a lot of fat in their minds.
Yeah, they kind of took advantage of the writer's strike.
Yes, and trimmed a lot of fat in what they considered fat. And so I was told I wasn't going to be renewed. And Lauren didn't, you know, he didn't have enough power. He didn't have enough juice to fight for it. And I really, you know, it really bothered me because I just didn't think that was appropriate to let someone go. A, been there for some 23 years.
Yeah.
Worked very hard, done a lot of good stuff for the show. B, they actually knew that I had a child with autism. Mm-hmm. Everybody knew it by then. And the expenses and difficulties that come with that.
Yeah.
And here they're just basically cutting me off, cutting off an income that I had planned for that year. And so Lauren went back and fought to get me one cartoon. I got to do one cartoon like when we came back in February, and that was it. And then I was gone. You know, fortunately, I had written the Zohan movie.
Mm-hmm.
And the Zohan movie came out in 2008 and it made a lot of money. And then I just sort of shifted into movies and started writing more movies, mostly with Adam, but other movies too. Not that they got made, but I made some good deals and I was able to make a living doing that. But yeah, that happened. And then within the same year, Conan moved to Los Angeles. So the two gigs that I had basically counted on as my foundation, financially and creatively, were gone because I had made an overall deal. Yeah, I made an overall deal with Conan's people to do the Clutch Cargos and to do Triumphs and was making a decent salary. So yeah, it was tough. And then it was just so funny because then I'm gone and the first show, Fall 2008, cold opening is Tina Fey as Sarah Palin. And the show that I'd always dreamed of being a part of, even though I love the show, but I always wanted that for Lauren. I always wanted that for Lauren and for myself too, to be a part of the show when everybody's talking about it.
Right. 'Cause
I grew up on the show and I had an amazing time doing the show, but it was never like it was in the 70s. And it was close. There were some moments where we did some great things.
Yeah.
You know, Dana's George Bush and Ross Perot. We got up there, but it wasn't like that. It was almost like I'd stepped away from 30 Rock and fireworks went off. It was almost like a bad joke on me. But that's okay. I was very happy for Lauren, really happy for him because he never talked as if the show wasn't in the center of everyone's conversation.
Well, in a way, it always was, but now then it really was.
Yeah, but then it really, really was.
Do you still watch the show?
I watch the show a fair amount. I don't watch it a lot. I'm an old man and I have two sons at home and the older boy and it's hard to stay up.
Yeah.
It's hard to be up at 11:30 on a Saturday night. So I try to catch, more often than not, I try to catch the sketches on YouTube the next day or on Monday when the kids are in school. I try to catch, I do follow the show and try to catch as much of it as I can.
I mean, your satire, as I said, has always been really hard hitting. What do you make of the way that the show has handled Trump?
I think it's, been up and down. It's a hard one. I think it's been hard for everybody in a way because he's such a sitting duck. Something I mentioned in a tweet few weeks ago was I feel like even during this terrible time, everything was focused on Trump. And like when the riots started, like for weeks, I felt like all the late night shows were still just making it all about Trump. This problem has existed long before Donald Trump. And I'm not giving Trump any kind of free pass by any stretch of the imagination. But my problem was that I know he's easy to make fun of. I know why he's easy to make fun of. I do it as much as anybody when I'm doing Triumph. But if you've got a platform and all you're going to make fun of is Donald Trump, then you're giving cover to a lot of people and you're providing cover for a lot of corruption
yeah.
that's rampant, that's and racism that's existed way before Donald Trump. And I'm not saying that he doesn't foment it at times and that he's not a part of it, but it goes way beyond him. And to just make it all about Trump is you're doing a disservice. You know, it needs to be out there. It's mm-hmm. not as easy to make fun of, you know, lobbyists or, you know, the police, the system of protection that's inherent in, you know, in our police force. But it's got to be done, you know, yeah. and absolutely with jokes.
Well, however, SNL does come back in the fall, whether it's still from home or live or what, it'll be interesting to see how they handle this. And especially because Alec Baldwin, I think, threatens every time that it's his last time and that he's done. And he's, you know,
it's almost like Groundhog Day, you know, if Alec says he's not coming back, that means 6 weeks till.
Yeah, till he comes back.
6 weeks till he comes back. If he says he is coming back, then it's 2 weeks.
Yeah. So before we wrap up, I want to run down just a few other things that we didn't get to talk about as sort of a speed round. We didn't mention your probably most famous on-screen role at SNL, which is DeBears.
Oh.
what do you remember about the first time that you actually did that, you know, on screen? And was that, it was kind of different for you to be
on screen? Yeah, I mean, I'd done little things on screen before, but I wrote it with Bob Odenkirk.
Yeah.
It was just three guys in their backyard drinking beers and having conversations that always ended in Dub Bears. It was a similar thing to Triumph, where the joke was how one-dimensional they were. And then Bob suggested that we copy this show called the Sports Writers on Television. Mm-hmm. It was a very popular Chicago show where three sports writers would, you know, argue about sports. These guys would be the guys, and then immediately, right, they can predict the games and mm-hmm. argue whether it's going to be Bears 62-3 or 65-7, you know, that kind of thing. Get into heated conversations about how badly the Bears were going to beat the other team. And so that made it more accessible. That little adjustment mm-hmm. made it something that everyone could understand and less indulgent. And so we did it with Joe Mantegna, and I wasn't supposed to be in it. I wrote it. I think somebody like Phil Hartman was in it. And, but Jim Downey was the head writer and producer, and he's from Joliet.
Yeah.
And he had heard me do it. And he felt, even though I was from New York, he thought that I had a better accent than
Phil Hartman.
No, well, for Hartman for sure. But even George Wendt and Joe Mantegna and Mike Myers is from Canada, and Farley was from Wisconsin, and he was kind of doing Dan Aykroyd's Erwin Mainway character for those really real SNL nerds out there. So Downey asked Lauren if he could put me in it, because he described it as like, I'll be like a metronome for the sketch, because Chicagoans hear one really good Chicago accent, then everybody else's accent is okay. Then they're all doing variations of the metronome,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then it's all right. And it made a lot of sense. And so, I got to do it. And then George Wendt happened to host at the very end of the year. And so Bob and I wrote another one. And by now it had become a big phenomenon in Chicago because the Bulls were coincidentally about to win their first championship. Honestly, I had more fun doing stuff in Chicago with those characters than even doing them on the show, because we got to literally stand in the center of Soldier Field before a playoff game mm-hmm. and give a pep talk in character. It was the dumbest thing they could have asked us to do, but they did. The characters were that popular. And then we did a field goal kicking competition at halftime.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And then where Farley fell flat on his face with a beer in his hand. And then I had to follow him. And the only way I can top this is making the field goal.
Yeah. That,
in my mind, that's all I could do. So I'm holding a beer in my hand and I just try really hard. And I cleared the goalpost. It was like a 20 yarder, but still I was like, I got a big cheer. It was quite a thrill. And then the Bulls won the championship. And the next year we got to go on stage at Grand Park in front of like hundreds of thousands of Bulls fans and perform before the Bulls came out to make their speeches.
Wild.
And we did this like three championships in a row.
That's
we would
insane.
Sing a song. I would write a song and George and I would do it, until one year. And this is interesting because of The Last Dance. Now everybody knows the intrigue that I knew about back then because I was very into the Bulls. But like Jerry Reinsdorf, even the year before the last Michael year, 1996, or even in 1996, the first year where Rodman was there, even that year, there was controversy. Will he have the players back? He doesn't want to renew Pippen's contract. What's he going to do? And the fans were furious. So George and I, like, we produced a church basket, a donation basket, and like threw it into the crowd and said, Everyone put in $20. Yeah, it'll cover Michael's first month. You know, help Jerry out. He's too cheap. And we were never asked back.
That was it.
We were never asked back. And then right after The Last Dance aired, I put this thing that had, I couldn't find it online. So I put it online of the superfans. So now we're at the 2000 ESPYs and the Bulls are being presented with athletes of the decade or as team of the decade. And Phil Jackson is no longer part of the team. He doesn't want to be there.
Yeah.
Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen's not with the team anymore. He doesn't want to be there. Michael Jordan is there to accept Athlete of the Decade, but he refuses to accept Team of the Decade without Phil Jackson and Scottie and his teammates. So they chose us.
to accept
they chose me and George to accept it. And we wrote the most scathing acceptance speech, shitting on Jerry Krause and Jerry Reinsdorf. It almost felt like an epilogue to The Last Dance.
Yeah.
It's very satisfying to watch it.
Vamos. Never in doubt. No question. Unfortunately, the Bulls could not be there tonight because Reinsdorf and Krause broke the damn team up.
Broke them up. Apparently, the team of the decade wasn't worth paying for. Six titles was plenty. I mean, who needs to watch Michael and Scottie win a few more titles when you can watch two fat white guys rebuild?
Go, Jerry's, go!
Get under that salary cap, Jerry's!
Yeah!
We briefly touched on the Dana Carvey show, but I wanted to talk about that because it's just such an incredible thing. And the people, I think, know, people either, maybe more people know after that documentary came out.
Oh my God, Too Funny to Fail.
With that it was you and Colbert and Carell and Dana Carvey and Louis C.K. and Charlie Kaufman. Who am I missing? Anybody?
John Glazer, who's a genius. John Glazer. One of the funniest people I know. And
that it only lasted
Dino Stamatopoulos.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the writer who created Moral Oral, and he was one of the foundation writers of Conan.
That it was just this incredible crew of people, and then of course the show only lasted seven or eight, depending on how you look at it.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah. I have a number of those under my belt, but that's the most famous now because of the because of that documentary.
Yeah. What kind of stands out for you from that whole experience?
I don't have happy memories of that time.
Yeah.
It was a very, very, like Conan, for some reason, the first year, it was a little like the first year of Conan, which was very, you know, we were in danger of being canceled constantly. Mm-hmm. Like we were getting 13-week renewals and that's it, literally for the first year. But I have wonderful memories of that one because somehow we were, even though we were, you know, hated by the network on some level and in danger, we were kind of left alone creatively. And we felt like this new group of people who were all connecting. Like I had just hired Louis and Dino and Andy Richter, and we were all on the same wavelength with me and Conan. And it was the most exciting gig ever to create that show out of nowhere. And try to make it original and funny. And we did so many crazy bits that a number of them fell flat in a hilarious way. But many of them, you know, he did for years and years, even from the first week. And it was just such a satisfying thing. Whereas the Dana Carvey show, we had network involvement creatively all the time. And we made an incredibly bad decision on the very first show. Like the first Conan show was actually a big success.
Yeah.
It was only after that once the excitement wore off that people said, oh, he seems nervous and the comedy's too crazy.
You had a great first cold open on Conan.
Absolutely. Conan and I wrote that together. And it's one of my favorite things I've ever been a part of. He just said, what if I'm just walking down the street with no idea? Because he was aware of the pressure. I just got a goofy smile on my face. And then I said, yeah, and how about let's have everybody who comes up to you say, a lot of pressure, Mr. O'Brien. Hope you're as good as Letterman. You know, just really cheerfully. And he says, I'll do my best.
Yeah, I think that that was great because it was so simple. But then maybe the Bill Clinton breastfeeding.
No, that was like an incredibly crazy swing of the bat. I mean, yeah. Conan's situation was so insane that it was fun and easy to write a self-deprecating thing about it. But what we did with Bill Clinton, we had a very simple premise where he's talking about his opponents and he keeps giggling because he can't help. He knows he's going to beat all of them.
Yeah.
And then Louis suggested, what if we have this other thing where he's gotten rid of Hillary because Hillary was very unpopular at the time. And he says, I have to be both the mother and the father to my country. And, you know, and then the breastfeeding idea. And then I made it worse by with my animal obsession. what if he has, forget breastfeeding. Why doesn't he have eight breasts? And then he can feed live puppies and kittens, you know, this is, I just love using live animals. And I'm literally the guy in the sketch who's handing him the live puppies and kittens. It's almost like, you know, a metaphor because I was the producer of the show and I'm just handing him bad reviews. Here's another little, isn't this bad review adorable? Look, it's only, this bad review's only 2 months old. And, you know, I was an idiot. I didn't know that we were following Home Improvement. I didn't know what Home Improvement was.
Yeah.
I didn't understand that Home Improvement was a wholesome show that children watched with their parents. And that's why it was number one. I thought Pamela Anderson's on it and Tim Allen dealt coke.
Yeah.
There's got to be.
What, that was your, in your imagination, that's what Home Improvement was.
Yeah, I don't, not exactly, but it was on at nine. It wasn't on in the family hour. I just didn't think, and you know, just bad producing. I should have watched it once. I watched it like 4 weeks in and I was literally just shell-shocked.
I wanted to just touch on Night of Too Many Stars because I know, you know, you mentioned your son who has autism and that's been a big, you know, part of your career now is this benefit and, you know, supporting that cause. So when you look back at, you've done a bunch of them now, are there any, you know, particularly special moments that stick out to you?
Oh yeah, 1,000%. I mean, there are comedy moments that stick out, like Chris Rock. We had this breakthrough idea about three shows in where we started auctioning off incredibly silly celebrity stunts. And Chris Rock suggested, what if I chew out the ex of the highest bidder? You know, I'll call them on the phone and I'll chew them out. And he did. And the guy picked up, he had dropped this girl on Facebook, like somehow it was just really fucked up. And he calls up the guy and just, I don't remember exactly what he said. It's still online somewhere. Chris Rock will chew out your ex. And Chris told me it was the biggest laugh he'd ever gotten in his career.
Wow.
Chris Rock telling me that. I know. But that's like, that was a real exciting thing because then that sort of turned a corner for the show where we, every year we started doing really absurd remotes. Al Pacino will be posed with your family in their Christmas card. Like these kind of Seth Rogen, take a pee with Seth Rogen. And they literally went to the men's room, like three bidders.
Yeah.
And they all took a piss with Seth Rogen.
That's hilarious.
As the camera followed them. And, you know, but then there's this other moment where Katy Perry, it's going to sound corny, but it wasn't. I mean, it was.
Oh, yeah, I remember this.
We had this girl, Jodi DiPiazza, who was 12 years old, this girl, and they made a beautiful film about her progress and how, you know, she couldn't connect through anything but music, and they found a way to get to her that way, and she turned out to be a prodigy. And, you know, she's still not, you know, what I'd call the highest functioning. She wasn't at the time. She still had a lot of issues with autism, but she was a great musician, and she loved Katy Perry. I loved a lot of musicians. I had the idea of having her do Firework with Katy Perry, and it was just, I was obsessed with making this happen. So we contacted Katy Perry's management and they passed. They said, she's busy, whatever. So then I had Jodi play it on her own and record it, and I sent it to them. And then I also had Sarah Silverman, who had not met Katy Perry, but I had remembered hearing, Sarah Silverman's a good friend of mine, and I had remembered seeing Katy Perry at like an MTV red carpet. They asked her, who do you admire? And she said, Sarah Silverman. I remembered that. Oh, just stuck with me. So I called Sarah and I said, would you contact her and tell her about this? And so she DM'd Katy Perry and then invited her to a party. And then she got Katy Perry to agree to do this. And it's just an amazing, it just took everybody. We had never had a moment like that before. And the greatest part about it was even before Katy Perry came out, which was amazing in itself. But Jodi was, just playing the beginning of the song, and we were transitioning from the video of her playing to her playing live, and the audience goes crazy. And there's this one moment where she's singing the song and she gets, there's another spontaneous applause. I'm not sure exactly what caused it, but it happened. And you just see a big smile on her face as she's singing. And it was so important because even when Daniel, my son, was diagnosed, I was reading all these books and hearing from therapists, and they would say things like, these kids lack what they called theory of mind. And what it meant was, is they had no ability to be empathetic. They couldn't connect emotionally the way, you know, typical people can connect. And I just, it's bullshit. I learned over the years that it's bullshit. And,
yeah.
And it's so important that people know that. Mm-hmm. And this moment that Jody had really showed it. So yeah, that's that moment, you know, that's to me the most important, special.
Yeah, that's pretty incredible.
Special thing I've ever been a part of. You know, yeah. You know, even more than making fun of nerds at Star Wars.
We end every episode by asking, who is a comedian who has made you laugh the hardest in your life?
Wow. You know, it's such a beautiful memory to think about the first time you laughed really hard.
Yeah.
At anything, you know, and for me, I have a couple, and I was able to tell Mel Brooks that there was one moment in Blazing Saddles, the choir is singing it in the church, and it's just a very corny song that's narrating the plot up to that point.
Mm-hmm.
But then the very last line, you finally, it slows down and it becomes a little melancholy. And the last verse, and you just don't see it coming, especially if you're 14. You know, da 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 da. Our town is turning into shit. And it was such a shock at that moment. And I just remember the theater I was in and how hard I couldn't stop laughing for like literally 5 minutes. You know, couldn't focus on the movie, just laughing so hard. And I'm so happy I got to tell Mel Brooks. The other one that's like that was when Andy Kaufman appeared on Saturday Night Live, and he played the foreign man, which, you know, evolved into Latka. But the original foreign man character was just a bad comedian who thought he could imitate Archie Bunker. And
and
now I'm going to imitate Archie Bunker, and you stupid, everybody's stupid. And, you know, he would get applause and say, thank you very much. And then he would try another one, and then he would start realizing, I'm not sure if you're laughing with me or laughing to me. I don't know. And then he starts literally crying.
Yeah.
Very convincing. Just, you don't, I mean to, I'm trying to.
Yeah.
But you made me. I'm trying to lose me. But you. I don't. And then it turned into a rhythm, and he bongos. Starts playing the bongos.
That's such a classic.
It's still the funniest thing.
Yeah, that it's is so just, funny.
It's crazy. It's so pure. God. It's so pure. It's, you know, and it just spoke to the 10-year-old in me. You know, that's one of the things I love about. You know, the silliest stuff I got to do after Saturday Night Live when I was, you know, starting Conan. One of the things that gave me such joy was that I was sort of set free from the sketch parameters, and we could just write the stupidest, purest stuff that, you know, spoke to me, speaks to the child in me. I like, even Triumph's voice was something that I did for Dogs when I was 10 years old. It wasn't. So that Andy Kaufman bit is, that's got to be the one.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for taking so much time. This was fantastic.
Okay, cool.
I'm such a huge fan of yours for so long. So this was really, really fun.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. I had a great time, honestly. Thanks so much.
Have a good one.
All right. You too.
All right. Take care. Bye. I am immensely grateful to Robert Smigel for giving me so much of his time and so many great stories on today's show. Check out his Quarantine Squares special on Funny or Die and YouTube, and follow at TriumphICDHQ on Twitter, where you can see all of his incredible content. And if you like this show, please tell your friends and rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. If you're not already, please follow @LastLaughPod on Instagram, where you can see photos and videos from all of our episodes. The Last Laugh is distributed by Acast for The Daily Beast, with audio production by Red Rock Music. Our theme music is by Claude. You can find on Instagram @claude.mp3. You can find this show every week on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.